get a degree and graduate from Denver?
No, no. So.
And were drugs a part of your story?
So I was smoking a lot of weed. Yeah, smoking a lot of weed. So that's mostly like what was pervasive was alcohol. Alcohol was pervasive for me and weed, cannabis. And, you know, but I'm a good alcoholic. Like I'm not saying no to things, but I did have my preferences and I was drinking until I was 29. Right. So like it evolved for me in terms of like how I was like disguising
the progression.
Yeah.
What's the biggest disguise? What's the most impressive disguise?
I like well, that word. That's a good one.
So I used to call myself I'm going to say this word wrong. I call it an onophile. I think I'm pronouncing that right. But someone who's like really into wine, oh. Right? Like a you know, because I eventually went to culinary school, and that's something that's like one of the commonalities that we have. And then I went into hospitality, and then I got really into wine. And I really do think wine is this way to disguise alcoholism, right? Right? It's like it's a hobby, you know, and it's like it's sort of like a highbrow. I mean,
there's
wine
a culture
is
about it.
Yeah.
And there's also like they used to say wine is healthy for your heart. Right. Choose wine right. over a vodka.
But not like drinking two bottles and then like
even one glass is yeah. poison.
Yeah.
Come on.
No, I know. So that was it. Like so it's like on the surface, it was like, oh, I want to be a sommelier and I want to like really get into it and like let me look at the wine list and but I was like a blackout. But what I was a blackout drunk. Like I would maybe have, yeah, like was never, and that's some of the romanticizing that I do of like, oh, it's just like a wine, like a rosé on a hot day. It's like, no, Laura, like it is like face down in a gutter.
Yeah.
Like with like a very large contusion somewhere, right? Or like, cause that's really what it looked at the end. It was like wandering the streets of, I mean, it really was like really dangerous.
Were you wandering the streets of where?
New York, yeah.
I remember yeah, when you first lost. Told me that.
The
vision is still there of like the Lower East Side story or other stories that you would tell me. Like it's so vivid in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, the first like incident of that I remember was I was living on the Upper West Side. I was drinking on Amsterdam Avenue with like my sister and like my boyfriend at the time. And I think I'm the kind of person where I'm like, I don't want to leave. I don't want to go home. And everyone's like, we aren't staying with you. Like, good luck. Like you're annoying. You're mean. Like we're leaving you. Right. And so I'd be like left there and I'd be like continuing to drink. And then it was one night and I don't really remember any of these nights. Cause like, I don't have memory. I'm kind of piecing it together based upon like just the evidence that I have. And this one night I left the bar on Amsterdam, took a cab up Central Park West. And then I think what happened is I got out of the cab, fell, hit my head, passed out on the street right there on Central Park and 100th Street in Central Park West. Was found by cops. Cops called an ambulance, but I kept saying like, I live right there, pointing to the building right in front of me. And they were like, we don't know if you live there. And like they called my boyfriend at the time and he's like, no, she lives here. Like this is correct. And they're like, well, we already called an ambulance. So him and I are going up to St. Luke's at the time. It's I think a Mount Sinai hospital now, but which is in like Harlem, which is like, it's not a great hospital to be in the middle of the night. I don't remember any of it. This poor guy I was with like had to like endure like basically a psych ward, you know, ER. And then like lost my wallet, had this huge, like, you know, bruise on the back of my head, pain. I woke up in my apartment. I was like, what happened? I had no idea. And he was like, well, this is what happened. It was pretty bad. I was like, where's my wallet? Great. My wallet's gone. And I called my parents and I was like, this happened. And like, because I had this contusion on my head, we collectively decided this triggered like I think a potential intervention for me with my brother who was down in Florida at the time.
You're 20 something at this time?
That's 24, 25. Yeah. This triggered an intervention. And then we collectively decided, my parents and I, that I was mugged. That's why I had a bruise. That's why I was hit on my head. That's why I lost my wallet. and then I was mugged. So it was actually like, it wasn't really my fault, and it right. wasn't as bad as it sounded.
A nice bow on
poor
it.
Laura. Yeah.
So like intervention off.
Yeah.
Intervention off. I ended up finding my wallet. Someone actually found it and like called me and like returned it.
It was an honest crook.
Yeah. Yeah. They returned it. And I still have that wallet. It was like this really nice wallet that I.
That's the main
good
part
memories.
Of the, it's the main part of the interview.
Yeah. Well, and I think really like what's thematic about that was like there were consequences. I wasn't really able to access these consequences that I was experiencing, right? These sort of like what they call in the big book, like moral hangovers. I didn't really understand that concept. Like who does really? I mean, maybe we can kind of understand it like in some way, but you know, not in,
right.
In,
you don't care as much because yeah. you're just going to,
well, I also like
the
had
wine
no memory.
Is more important.
Yeah. I had no memory. It's like, how do I feel bad about something I don't remember? Right. You know, like, and I, you know, it doesn't mean that shame didn't build, but so there were a few instances like that, a lot of like excuse making. Yeah. I mean, my last hurrah was the same thing. It was like, but I was in Bushwick. I got lost on my way to my apartment
in
Bushwick.
I know.
And ended up at a hospital out there. And I came to in the middle of the night and was like in like an alcohol induced psychosis probably. And like running around because I guess there's a law in, I don't know if it's a New York State law, but it's a law. Certainly it exists in New York State where like when drunk people are taken to ERs, you take their wallet and you put them in gowns. That's what they did. And I was put in a gown and I had my wallet and they don't let you have any of that back pretty until you are sober, right? The next day. I guess that makes sense, right? That's the whole point. And I was talking to the doctor there and I was like, you have to let me leave. Like, this is, you're holding me against my will. And he was like, no, we're not going to let you leave. Like, we called your mom when she comes to get you in the morning. Like, we'll let you go. He's like, if you don't go lie in your bed, we're going to like strap you to your bed. Like, that's what we're going to do. And I was like, fine. Strapped to my bed. And then
strapped you to the bed?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then several hours later, like I woke up and I was like, you know, fine. And my mom was came from Bedford to Bushwick to come pick me up. And I was like, okay, so I'm 29. Like, this is really sad. And like, it was actually, I went to detox that day, yeah. Flew down to West Palm Beach that day. So like, that was, I mean, obviously like there was, you know, that first incident in when I was 24, you know, 5 years later, I mean, there was a lot, there's a lot of just like, unmanageability. Mm. Like there was like a marriage in there. There was like, I owned a restaurant. It was like all over the place, like just making all these like weird decisions about my life. Yeah.
So you're 29, you're in a detox in
yes.
West Palm. Why West Palm?
Well, I was going to go down to Renaissance and that was just, at the time it was just this, that was the detox they were using. It was in Jupiter.
Remember.
Yeah. It was in Jupiter. Oh. They were, it was a
different one.
The family knew about.
Yeah, there was like, well, it was like, you know, you call the treatment center and they're like, well, you know, it's obviously the treatment center doesn't do detox. They're like, she needs to go here first. And then once she's medically cleared, she can admit. So
And did you go kicking and screaming or were you kind of
No.
29,
I was like,
I see my
yeah,
consequences.
Yeah, I was ready. I was ready.
Yeah.
I was so ready. Like from then on, I was. Like, I mean, like there are moments of like resistance, of course, but like, I was like, well, what I now realize is that I'd done my first step, right? I'd done my first step like weeks leading up to that, where I was like, I'm powerless. I wasn't using that language. I didn't know about the first step, but I was like, the first step
of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes.
For people who don't know.
Yeah. Of Alcoholics Anonymous of, I can't stop drinking. I don't have any other, but I don't know what else to do. I don't know how to stop. And it's helping me in these ways. And I think I literally said that to my sister on a train up to our parents' house. Was like, I need to stop drinking. But like, I don't know how to. And then like 3 hours later, like we're at like a weekend. It was a Morley weekend. I was drinking. So when I finally went to an AA meeting, like a treatment, I was like, I did my first step. Certainly then, and then I did my first step in that
hospital. When you were strapped to the bed, you
yeah.
kind of were like, this is not me.
Yeah.
Like, what's happening?
Yeah, I was like, I can't. I mean, there's no way I'm never going to be the person, the woman I want to be and have the life I want to have if I keep doing this, like, right. And it was like, it really was like a switch.
Switch.
Like from one day I'm like, you know, this is the solution. This is the solution. This is the solution being the alcohol to like, this is the problem. And like, I need help.
And you were ready for another way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how about the family, your siblings, your family, what was that relationship like at this moment in time?
It was good. I mean, it was fine. I mean, you know, I definitely like was living with my sister for a good chunk of time. And so there was definitely some things that she was pretty unhappy about with me. My parents, I mean, look, I mean, when I left on the flight, the JetBlue flight down to West Palm, they all came with me. Like they brought my dog and everyone, like I went alone, right? They all just like said goodbye. And so everyone was like,
that was really nice of them.
Yeah. Everyone, no one was really, I mean, I think everyone just felt really, I think everyone was just like sad.
Right.
Like it was just sad. It wasn't like.
You weren't hurting them directly, but you were hurting yourself. So
yeah.
Bad.
I mean, I was so disconnected. Yeah. Like I was, you know, yeah, I was in. Really, I was actually probably the most disconnected from my parents at that time. I was working at the Nomad. I was working at in the hospitality industry as a server, and so I was working all. I was never around for Christmas. I mean, I just was like, I was really disconnected.
Right.
Yeah. So I think they're all relieved, and so it was like a good. It was good. It was like a good next chapter for me. And I think immediately my parents like forgave me. Like I did do an amends process. But again, like the destruction I caused was so, I mean, I hurt other people. I definitely like don't have a lot of friends as a result of like being an alcoholic for so many years, like friends from my past. Cause I just burned bridges, and didn't know how to maintain relationships. But again, like that's part of the relational stuff I've always struggled with. But I was really hurting myself a lot. I mean, it was just mostly self-destruction. It wasn't.
The relational stuff that you struggled with always, yeah. To use your words, was that primarily related to alcohol or was that an underlying problem that was also present?
Yeah, I think the alcohol supported some of the, helped it a little bit, right? It was like that sort of social lubricant and feeling more at ease and, you know, I definitely probably was the kind of person that said like, no, alcohol makes me feel more like myself. Right. But I think what it was, I think when people say that, what they're experiencing that lowering of inhibitions, right. It's really this, like we're giving ourselves permission to be maybe like, and again, there's a threshold, right? Like there's maybe that first drink, you can feel more like yourself. And then I think there's like immediate diminishing returns. to like
yeah.
some kind of
never
you know,
gets
it's like,
better
like immediate diminishing returns, but I get that, like I think there's something when people feel like that, at least how I felt, it's like if I recall that like this, there's this permission we maybe give ourselves to maybe be able to act in a way that like, no, I want to be connected, I want to be sociable, but like because I hate myself and I think I'm bad, wrong and defective, like I can't
engage.
You know, it's so funny, I don't even want to remember that first part.
Yeah.
Because that first part was very pleasant.
Yeah, right. That's the deception.
But I don't want to
even
think about that first part.
Which is an interesting, and that sort of just makes the, I mean, I, you know, substance use disorder and addiction, it is, I mean, that's what makes the disease so like different to treat, right? Because like what other disease is like, like telling you, like romanticizing things for you, right? But I always, so when I was down at Renaissance, I was 29, and I remember there was a range of people there, but I was like definitely like kind of skewed on the older side. And then you had, you know, like a lot of 24-year-olds, and then there was a couple like 18-year-olds. And I remember one being kind of like, you know, I'm 29, like this sucks, like I'm so far behind, you know, like all those things you think when you're like in treatment for 6 months, and that I hear even now people say. So I know it's like kind of a global sense or global feeling. But I remember thinking like, what's, at least I have this experience of like what it looks like, right? Like the tape being played through. Like I know like what it looks like after a year, after, you know, my early 20s. It's like just dark. And like, I mean, I remember like right before, right, it was, I think it was 2014, I like fell. And I still have like a really bad like scar right here. I fell like on my steps up to my apartment and like slammed my chin on like the steps. It was like these like really old crappy steps that had metal that lined the edge. And I hit my chin and broke my teeth and like had this like huge bruise right here for like weeks. Mm. So I was like, okay, well, that's what it looks like.
Right. So then what does life look like, you know, in treatment? Is there anything that you would want to highlight about that experience?
I mean, treatment was long. It was hard. Yeah. There was a few things. There was like a few things that came out. So I was like a very like willing client, right? Like I just was like, I know nothing. Right. I got a sponsor and I was like, whatever you tell me. And like, again, it wasn't perfect. Like there are ways in which, like, I remember my sponsor like confronted me one during our fourth step and was like, I wasn't doing it enough, or it wasn't like, I missed a part. And like, I remember like crying and like being really like upset about it. So I wasn't perfect. I wasn't like, again, I even using that word perfect, right? Like that's how easily that creeps up for me. But I was doing, like, I was in a place where I knew I didn't know, right? So a lot of willingness, but it was hard. Like it was, you know, it was long. I was there for 6 months.
Is there something that you learned during your experience in that 6 months that you remember, like a bold recollection?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the interventions that my team, I guess my care team, like pushed me towards was developing female relationships. One, because I already named that I had a really hard time like developing platonic intimate relationships with people. I burned a lot of bridges. And then, you know, I think I went from like relationship to relationship. So like I was, you know, and as a result, I would sort of lose friendships. I would lose like, you know, these platonic female relationships. And so my therapist was like, you need to basically like, you can't interact with men for like a year, and you need to make relations, like friendships with other women who are like in the program and, you know, preferably like people who aren't still in treatment. So they're like your sober supports. Right. Right. So I was like, oh, okay, great. So I was like, I'll do that. Yes. That actually sounds like that makes sense. I will do that. And I made a concerted effort to cultivate meaningful relationships with people, with women, in so much that like, when you go to like these, you know, this particular treatment center, it's like, in order to get off property, you have to like have connections with people outside. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely on the other end where people just like use you to like go get coffee somewhere.
Yeah.
And I remember being like really cognizant around like, okay, if I need to like cultivate relationships, like it needs to feel like two real ways. So like, right, I would call, you know, some of these women up and I'd just be like, hey, I'm just calling to say, hey, like, how was your week? Like, I mean, it was a landline and my phone, you know, it was like, I wasn't texting people, but it was just like, it wasn't asking for anything. I was just like nurturing this budding relationship.
Did it feel weird at the beginning?
No, it actually felt like, you know, I mean, I think I was lucky that I met some people that I really liked. And so like, I think it felt like good.
Yeah.
And then by the time I was done the treatment, I had these like, this amazing group of friends, of these women who were older than me. And they also like had gone through before me. And that was the first time ever I had any, like a core group of friends ever. Like even in high school, yes. But after high school, like I didn't maintain any of those relationships really. So, and that was like, and then what happened on top of that was the treatment center I went to was like, you can't use your parents as emotional support anymore. So if you're having a tough day or like something's going on in your life, you can't go dump on them. You have to use your sober supports to manage these trials and tribulations of your life now. And you certainly can't use them for, you know, they're not going to support you emotionally or financially either. And that was like one of the hardest things that they asked us to do. And my parents were like, I remember calling them up one day and being like crying about something that was going on. And they're like, we can't talk to you. and they hung up, and it was like really hard, but it ended up being like the most transformative intervention, because what it supported was like this process of differentiating from my family system that I was so enmeshed with and infused with, and it supported individuation, right, which was like a process I really never accomplished as an adolescent, like really individuating, right? That's hence the fusion. And I made this like, I mean, I did, I made this like life for myself down there. It was like very separate from, it was separate from my family, but it wasn't separate from this place of like shame. It was separate from this place of like health and growth of like, no, this is where, like, this is my life. I mean, when I look back on my time in Florida, like it's only positive.
Right.
It's only good, positive experiences and memories. I was going to tons of meetings, tell people that now, like I did, I did AA like really thoroughly.
And it's probably a sense of accomplishment, I would imagine,
yeah,
building kind of a life without your family's financial support,
yeah,
and knowing you can kind of do it on your own, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's how you build self-confidence. It's how you build self-esteem. Like, right. I needed that. I needed to know that, like, I could do it. I mean, you know, I obviously, like, after that, I ended up going back to grad school. My parents supported me during grad school, but it was like there was this... And then as soon as I got, you know, I got a job, and then I was sort of on my own again. But it wasn't like, again, it was that it made sense. For, I mean, I wanted to get my master's degree. Like my parents weren't going to put me in a position where I was going to have like student loans. Like,
right,
that wouldn't,
right,
make sense. So they, you know, they're like, we'll, you know, we're going to pay for your school. Like, you've been doing the right thing for the last year. And
let's go back to an age, an impactful age for you.
Yeah.
Give yourself some advice. What would that advice be? Tell us what age you'd be and what advice you'd give yourself.
So it would be around that like first grade, right? And I don't think it would be advice. I think it would be, you're okay.
Yeah.
Like you're going to be, you are okay. Not even you're going to be okay. Like you are okay. And like the person would like kneel down and like come to my eye level and like they hug you. I think that's what it would be.
Thank you for sharing that with, mm-hmm, us.
And the advice that you just gave yourself, it's something we probably all needed.
Yeah.
Some more than others, but everybody needed that.
Yeah.
Because when we really, this whole journey of life, and for most of us that watch Crosstalk Podcast, it's about, mm-hmm, finding, finding the right way to do this so, yeah, we feel good and we have, yeah, lives that matter. We all find out, if we're really lucky, that we're good people.
Yeah.
We did some crazy shit. But, you know, we really are,
yeah,
fine. And I don't know, maybe it's my own personal prejudice. I find that we're like extra fine.
Yeah.
As a general group.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. Somebody will explain that to me, that smarter than I.
There's like, it's like, for me, it's always just like, there's something, like, we're lucky in a way, right? Like, it's not, we're lucky because we're free of having to use substances, but I think even embarking on this like depth-based work, right? It's like, it's most people don't choose to do it. Most people are happy.
Yeah.
With the safeguards that they've put in place with these protect, I mean, again, it's, that's okay. And like, that's not on, it's not for any of us to say you should be doing this or you shouldn't be doing this. So those of us that have like decided to really look at this stuff and examine things that are like, we want to shut the door on, you know, it's actually a privilege.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking us on this journey.
Thank you. I hope it's felt cohesive and
I mean, you have so much knowledge and we appreciate it, but I really loved seeing your journey as someone who's like really gone inside. And the Laura I met 7 years ago, 8 years ago, 8 years ago, shit, is not the same Laura I'm sitting in front of today. Yeah. And that is fucking cool.
Okay, cool. Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you. That helped. That's helpful for me because like I, you evolution. Know, I can't.
Like it's not in a bad word, yeah. Right? Like yeah. It's not binary, yeah. But like, it's so cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I love this work. Yeah. I love seeing people evolve and be able to identify whatever it is and decide to look at it.
Yeah. Right? Yes. Thank you.
You want to close this out?
I will. And thank you so much for being a part of Close Talk.
Thank you.
We're really lucky to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Keep watching us. Follow, subscribe, smack the bell. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. Irene and I are not going anyplace. So keep watching. And Irene, you have anything you want to add?
No, just thank you for joining us today. Let us know if there's something you want to see that we're not giving you.
Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.